This is East End Inc. Today we present novelist and short story writer Simon Van Bui, reading from his short story collection, The Sadness of Beautiful Things. Simon Van Bui was recorded at Canio's Books, Sag Harbor, in December 2018.
So the story I'll read tonight is based on a tale that was told to me by a woman called Mrs. O'Callaghan. And I was in Ireland, she wanted to have me over for something to eat, which, of course, I can't refuse. And her son wanted to be a writer, and she wanted to ask, you know, how do you get into the business? And he's in the business now, and his first book comes out with Harper in his first big novel comes out with Harper in May, and it's called My Coney Island Baby. But if you like horror, he wrote a book called The Dead House, which is frightening, truly frightening, in a good way. I like writing because it's completely unlike a lot of other forms of exploration or entertainment, because I suppose when I read a book, I have to actually write the book myself, because when I read words, I suppose I have to imagine everything I'm reading. So therefore, the book only comes to life through my own experiences. So when I write something and then you're so kind as to read it, you're using your own life experience to bring it to life. So essentially, it's your story. That's the nice thing about the writing community, is that it's one story, but it's also simultaneously everybody's individual story. You know, because when you watch television, there's no real imagination, you know, unless there's some kind of subtext. But with writing, it's like taking, you know, those croissants you get at King Cullen and they're not quite made, but you can... I always overcook them, but thank you very much. And I will read this story called A Sacrifice. Until the fire, nobody much cared for the McCrutchins. They just weren't used to living in a town. The children were rowdy and unkempt and walked five abreast along the pavement, laughing at the old and shouting silly things at other people's children. Mr. and Mrs. McCrutchin had been married since they were teenagers. The service took place in a stone church. Maggie was a young bride, even by country standards. Standing barefoot in white, she concentrated on what the priest was saying without truly understanding. The groom's mother gave her a piece of silver jewellery and she wore it around her neck. The groom arrived with his friends. He wore a gold hoop in one ear. The sleeves of a dark suit fell over his knuckles. They rode away on a chestnut horse. To be a McCrutchin child meant knowing every detail of that story. And it's just a matter of time, their mother would sometimes say when she put them to bed, before the lot of you start falling in love, one by one, like bottles knocked off a wall. So they moved to the village of Douglas because the school was known for being good. Mr. and Mrs. McCrutchin dreamed their children might get on in life, but then their house burned down. Some said it was a cigarette or an unattended toaster. Others believed it was a candle blown into net curtains. There hadn't been a fire like this in Douglas for 30 years. The street had to be blocked off with orange cones. The neighbours were told to move their cars. The McCrutchins bunched together on the glistening tarmac in their night clothes. Firemen rushed about with hoses and ladders, trying to save the other houses. Maggie McCrutchin was crying in front of everybody. The money her husband had given her to get insurance a year before she'd paid to the dentist, as her daughter had crooked teeth and people at school were laughing. The children had to stay with different neighbours because no one had room for all seven. The next morning, their blackened, dripping things were carried into the street. The Garda put up fences to keep people out. The youngest had left her doll in the panic to escape. So one of the fire inspectors came back after his shift to look for it, but had a new one in his pocket just in case. Then a month after the fire, very early, a fleet of workmen's trucks drove slowly up the street, then parked outside the charred ruin. The fences came down, and there were workers from Cork and engineers from Dublin tramping about in their boots with charts and cameras and special equipment that was yellow and orange. The McCrutchins were living in a bungalow owned by the church near the quarry, a place empty for years and riddled with damp and mould. But it cost nothing more than regular appearance at Mass. When the McCrutchin children heard at school about the workmen and the ladders going up on their old house, they thought it was a joke. But eventually a woman from the building department showed up at the bungalow. Signatures were needed so work could proceed. At first, everyone thought the church had called in a favour from Rome. But one of the workmen, on his tea break, said it was a neighbour who'd arranged everything through Dublin lawyers, as they wished to remain anonymous. All the McCrutchins had to do was pick the tile, choose the paint, and find carpet with a pattern they liked. Dogs who'd barely left the fireplace in years were now being dragged around the block several times a day. The hunger for gossip was insatiable. A few neighbours pretended they knew who it was, but had been sworn to secrecy. Husbands coming home late from the pub on Friday night would get into bed and confess to their wives' secret hoards of euros. Eventually, someone on the street did find out. A woman called Penny Carr, known for her chrysanthemums. This is how it happened. About 12 months after the fire, the McCrutchins moved into their rebuilt home. They had a party and invited the neighbours, the guards, the fire crew, the priest, and even some of the workers. Everyone had to take their shoes off, and the youngest McCrutchin children were charged with arranging them in size order by the front door. There was a rumour the identity of the benefactor would be revealed at the party, and so the whole street packed the McCrutchin house with drinking and eating and singing and dogs and children running over the new carpet in their bare feet. The only person not in attendance was Kitty O'Donnell, who lived at number 77. She'd gotten fairly ill, and most of the time now was propped up in bed with the television on and something hot to drink. Kitty was a local woman who'd grown up in the city of Cork, near Douglas. She moved to the village with her husband when they got married, and after he died, she was alone. The day after the McCrutchins' housewarming, Penny took some cake to her elderly neighbour, Kitty. They had a nice talk. Mostly things on the news and, of course, the weather. The old woman kept patting Penny's hand. "Do you not have many visitors, Mrs. O'Donnell?" "Not so much. Just me left now." With her husband at work in the day and their one daughter at the college in Dublin, Penny decided to go over again a few days later. She called first on the telephone, and Kitty said to use a key under the flower pot. The front room was full of still grey light that seeped through delicate curtains of lace, now yellow with age. Mrs. O'Donnell said they'd been from the time of her wedding. There were photographs of her husband in pretty frames, looking as Kitty remembered him from their long and happy life together. And it had been a good life, better than most. Kitty knew that and was grateful for it. The visits from Penny became regular. One day, Kitty sat up too quickly and knocked over her tea. The mug didn't break, but the carpet was wet. Penny got down and soaked as much as she could into a hand towel. "It was me, you know," Mrs. O'Donnell said as her neighbour pushed on the stain. "What paid for the McCrutchins' house?" Penny laughed. "You, Kitty?"
I
never would have guessed it was you. Well, now you know. So you're the secret millionaire on the street, is it?"
"That's right."
Penny looked up, wondering if the old woman's mind was starting to falter. Where'd you keep it then? Under the mattress, is it? Down in the town, she said proudly, locked up in the bank for safekeeping. When Penny thought the stain was faint enough, she stopped rubbing and put the towel on the tray to go downstairs. I'm not joking, Penny. You promised to keep it under your hat. Well, if you're the secret millionaire, Kitty, at least tell me how you came to have such a fortune. Lottery, was it? You really want to know? Aye. Because it's a long story and a sad one, so I'm all ears, Kitty. Maybe on your next visit. Penny laughed with some awkwardness. Well, if you want, I can make you some lunch and you can tell me after we've eaten. Mrs. O'Donnell couldn't resist. You're afraid I'll die before you come round again? Her neighbour's cheeks burned. I'll be 92 in the spring, Penny. Oh, I know, it's a grand age, so it is. After opening a can of soup, then pouring it into a silver pot to heat, Penny looked around at all Kitty's things, searching for some clue to her wealth. But the interior of number 77 was like every other home on the street. A sturdy kitchen table, bills stacked behind a small battery-operated clock, a bread bin full of little hard crumbs, a cold fireplace in the sitting room, and a cabinet of ceramic figures painted in old clothes that were supposed to have value. After eating the soup and brewing another pot of tea, Mrs. O'Donnell said she was ready. The story began in 1901. A little girl has just been born on a farm outside Douglas. Her name was Celia Riley. She had a nice time growing up, wandering the fields, walking her father to the pub, fetching water in buckets, the smell of green grass in summer, hay in winter. She was 15 years old when she met someone, a boy, just a little older than herself, from a village in the north of Ireland. He was down helping in the fields, earning money in the warm weather. After glancing at each other a few times, Celia and the young man took walks. They weren't supposed to be alone, but could always find a quiet path outside the village to hold hands. At the end of the summer, the boy went with his brother to fight in France against the Kaiser. They both died in the first week. Why they went, nobody really knew. It might have been the adventure, or an excuse to see Paris and hear a foreign tongue.
This is East End Inc. We're listening to Simon Van Bui reading A Sacrifice, a short story from his collection The Sadness of Beautiful Things.
At first, Celia thought it was sickness in her body from the shock of his violent death. She stayed in bed for several days, being looked after by her mother. Later on, it was clear to her what was happening. She sat her parents down in the kitchen and told them everything. The walks, the soft words, his promises, the brutal but honourable way he died. And lastly, that inside her body was all that remained of him in the world. Her mother studied the floorboards without moving. Then her father stood in his clean, heavy boots and went to the cupboard. The key was in his waistcoat pocket. Celia thought she was going to be given some money, but he took down his shotgun. Celia's mother rushed up and put her hands over the barrel, but his mind was made up. She was allowed to go upstairs and pack a few of her things, but it was hard to see through such wet eyes. He waited for her downstairs with the front door open, the gun over his arms, the twin barrels like hard, eyeless sockets. She could hear her mother's voice, a long, low, petitioning whisper. Celia's father walked her to the edge of the village. People who were out stopped to look at them. After he'd gone back, she sat by the roadside and looked at things without really seeing them. Then her mother came. She sat with her and they held one another. Then they walked the long road into Cork. There was a convent with spiked gates that accepted girls in her situation. After a week, it was all arranged. Celia would carry the child. Then once it was born, she would hand it over. The sisters already knew who the parents would be and were delighted. Celia could live at the convent then and work for the nuns. But over the years, her mother had saved money from the odd scrap of sewing, and it was used for a ticket to America. There, she said, her daughter could forget her mistake. 8 months later, Celia gave birth to a girl. She'd worked at the convent all that time and learned to hide inside the person everyone saw and spoke to. During delivery, she was allowed to look at the baby, but not hold it, nor touch its face. She was lucky, the sister said. Most girls had to stay in the convent and work for the church for the rest of their lives to atone for their sin against him. The voyage seemed to take a very long time. Celia met some nice people on the ship who gave her advice about what to do when she got to America, what to say to the immigration men, and how to behave. Her mother had arranged for work as a maid in a big house in Lower Manhattan. She could receive letters from home, but never send them. It was hard work, but there was lots to eat in the evenings when the family went out, and Celia could pretend it was her house. After a few months, an earring went missing. Celia looked everywhere. The woman told her that stealing was like lying to God. Celia didn't realize she was being accused and agreed wholeheartedly. By that time, though, she'd made a few friends. One of them lived in a house for girls run by a former schoolteacher who agreed to give Celia a week or two of lodging until she could find a new situation. But without a reference, it was not easy. Celia imagined her former mistress discovering the earring, perhaps in the bedding, then begging her to come back. One day, she noticed a sign in the window of a restaurant. It was where the Italian section began. But in the evenings, Celia liked to walk all over. Help was wanted making dough. The restaurant was dark with burgundy drapes and oil paintings of ruined castles and shipwrecks. It was outside regular eating hours, but in the kitchen, men were sitting on crates playing cards. When she told them she wanted to help make the dough, they took cigarettes out of their mouths and laughed. But one of them, a stocky Sicilian called Reggie, got up and asked what experience she had. Celia told them how, as a girl, she'd made the family bread with her mother and knew all the tricks. When he spoke, the other men went quiet. He was very dark and had a barrel chest. After a few months, she'd learned a few words of Italian, and Reggie knew a folk song in Irish about a goat. As he was several inches shorter than Cecilia, they drew glances as he walked her back to the boarding house every night. Then he waited by the gate until the door had opened and she was inside. A year later, Reggie had saved and borrowed enough to open his own place. Would Celia work for him? She could be in charge, he said. Wasn't that what women wanted? All this time, Celia had been trying to keep away from her feelings. But she left her job to work with the ambitious Sicilian. And he was right. She wanted to be in charge. After another year, on one of their walks home, Reggie asked if she might marry him. She quickly told him she couldn't. When they got to the boarding house, he waited at the gate, like always, to make sure she got safely inside. And because of this, she accepted his proposal the next day. 3 years later, they had four restaurants and a factory in the Bronx, making pasta to supply other eating houses in the city. They were best friends as much as husband and wife. And while she knew about his temper, Reggie had never once raised his voice or spoken harshly in her presence. Eventually, of course, she told him. She had to. It was too hard, living out a marriage with a lie underneath. She feared her husband would be upset, and he was upset, but not for the reason she thought. He stood with his hands flat on the walnut desk. "You gotta go to Ireland and get her. And bring her here, Reggie, to be with us." "Yeah, but don't be surprised if she's taller than me." "But what will people think? What will they say when I return with a child?" "To hell with people. Will you come with me?" He said that he would not, that it was something she needed to do alone. A few days later, Celia Fidanzati sailed first class on the Blue Stork. For most of the trip, she was on deck in her long coat, but sometimes she went down to the shared quarters and made friends with girls who were alone. It was a week before Kitty O'Donnell's 82nd birthday when a lawyer came to Douglas from Dublin to see her. He was a partner in the law firm, and from his briefcase he took a folder with copies of Celia's marriage and death certificates stamped by the New York authorities. He also had photographs of a newspaper article, something from the obituary section of the New York Times. At the bottom of the article was a photograph of Celia and Reggie when they were first married, when the company was just the two of them. Also in the lawyer's possession was a letter written by Celia that he offered to read aloud because by now Mrs. O'Donnell's hands were shaking. The things written in that letter were difficult to accept. The lawyer sat there and let her take it in. When she cried, he gave her a tissue. When she really wept, he stepped outside and waited until she was ready to go on. "It's a hard thing to find out so late you was adopted," the lawyer told Kitty. "I think the worst of it," she said, her voice faltering, "was that I never got to thank my parents, the ones who adopted me. I would like to have thanked them for making me believe I was theirs." The lawyer was good-natured.
"Ah, you were theirs."
"Oh, how I loved them," Kitty said. "And I would like to have told my husband, not that it would have mattered much, but we told each other everything, you know." Soon it was time for the lawyer to leave.
"Now don't you rush, Mrs. O'Donnell, and don't give a thought to the money until you've made peace with yourself. That's just my advice."
She didn't move for a long time until it was dark, and one by one, things in the kitchen began to disappear. With the papers still spread out before her on the table, a memory came back. It was something deep and hidden, which the day's events must have dislodged. When Kitty was 9 or 10 years old, she saw a woman standing at the end of her street. She had on a long coat with a belt, and her hair was pinned neatly under a hat. The street was full of children running and shouting, but the woman was looking at her. She was sure of it. Just standing there, at the end of the road, staring at her. She remembered that she stopped jumping. The rope fell slack. The woman stood out against the grey, wet houses. Kitty remembered that in the pocket of her house dress was a marble. She had found the marble and wondered if it belonged to the woman and that she had come to claim it. Then it started to rain, but the woman in the long coat did not move. She just stood there at the end of the road, staring as the heavy drops soaked into her clothes and the other children disappeared, one by one, into their homes. There was family in America, the lawyer had told her. But Kitty felt it was too late, just too late for anything to be changed, except, of course, in her heart. That was very changed. She felt open now, to the world, to the people suffering, and the places outside the village that she heard about on the news. The terrible things they went through were the things her mother must have felt too. But as she aged, Kitty O'Donnell, of number 77, found herself thinking mostly about her grandfather, the man who had marched his child to the edge of the village with a gun. She thought about him a lot. She even went and found where he was buried, and then lay down on the ground and put her arms around the stone where his name was written.
This is East End Inc. We heard Simon Van Bui recorded at Canyons Books in Sag Harbor in December 2018. He read A Sacrifice from his short story collection, The Sadness of Beautiful Things, published in 2018 by Penguin Random House. Simon Van Bui, who grew up in rural Wales, is also the author of, among others, The Secret Lives of People in Love and Love Begins in Winter, which won the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award. His novels include The Illusion of Separateness, published in 2014, and Everything Beautiful Began After, published in 2011, both by Harper Perennial. His work has been translated into 13 different languages. Some upcoming free literary events, sponsored by Canyons Cultural Cafe, 290 Main Street in Sag Harbor, include on Saturday, April the 27th at 5 p.m., novelist Frederick Tooten presents his new memoir, My Young Life. And on Saturday, May the 18th at 5 p.m., biographer Colin Asher presents Never a Lovely So Real, The Life and Work of Nelson Algren. And on Thursday, June the 6th through Sunday, June the 9th, a weekend of readings and events celebrating Herman Melville's bicentennial, including a marathon reading of Melville's Moby Dick at various Sag Harbor locations. More events are listed at canyons.wordpress.com. East End Inc. programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Marianne Callendrell and Catherine Zilker. This is Hazel Kahn.